This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some parts of Bloomington show up a glaring red on a federal map marking food deserts. The Veggie Cooperative is one organization trying to change that.
Some of this is a convenience issue, that if there's fresh produce near you and that you can easily access it, you're more likely to go get it and eat it.
Deb Halperin and others address the lack of access to nutritious food on Bloomington's west side in Judy Valente's report on food deserts. You'll hear about some of the new restaurant developments last year and what's new in the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene this year from the man who runs the Facebook page of the same name. And during the GLT Datebook, find out what artists who teach are also doing. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 5th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Neighborhoods that don't have easy access to fresh, healthy food are known as food deserts. West Bloomington qualifies. In a recent study, the Stevenson Center at Illinois State University cites West Bloomington's lack of access to healthy food as one of the sources of inequality in Bloomington Normal. GLT's Judy Valente explores why the area remains a food desert and what some community groups are doing to help.
There's an acre and a half of land adjacent to Sunnyside Park on the west side of Bloomington that come summer will transform into plots of garden-grown vegetables.
We've grown a lot of tomatoes. We're thinking of expanding our potato and sweet potato production as well, different greens, collards, Swiss chard, kale, really just anything, you know, anything that people want.
Colleen Connolly is one of the organizers of the West Bloomington Active Garden. Residents can cultivate about 10 individual plots in the garden between May and October each year. It's one of the few ways that people in this part of the city can get access to fresh produce.
We are in a food desert over here. So what we're trying to do here is really not just giving people food, but also developing tools to produce one's own food.
A food desert is a part of town where residents don't have easy access to supermarkets or other stores where they can purchase produce, fresh meat, and other staples for healthy living. Food deserts usually are located in low-income and minority neighborhoods. Deborah Halperin is a board member of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project.
These are the types of areas where we see people buying milk at gas stations and, you know, buying snacks from convenience stores instead of having the opportunity to easily access fresh produce or a larger store where they could do more shopping.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture publishes a map of every zip code in America showing neighborhoods that are food deserts. West Bloomington appears on the map as a red square, the designation for places where residents have to travel 1 to 20 miles to get fresh food. What West Bloomington does have in excess is a variety of fast food restaurants and convenience stores, as a tour of the neighborhood with Colleen Connolly of the Bloomington Active Garden shows.
Predominantly things that are high in calories, high in sugar, high in fat, high in sodium. I think maybe I've gone in, there's usually like one little line of baskets that maybe has like some apples or fruit. But a majority of it is like highly processed foods.
We step inside a convenience store that's part of a pilot gas station on Market Street. Hot dogs and fried tostados warm on a rolling grill. Display cases full of chips, candy, and other snacks line the aisles. A wall of coolers offers beer and sugary soft drinks. In a side aisle are three small baskets offering bananas and apples. The convenience store sits amid a fast food haven that includes KFC and Popeye's fried chicken restaurants, a Taco Bell, and a Wendy's. As we head east to the Veterans Parkway shopping district, Connolly notes the food options on this side of town are quite different.
Stores being placed where they are, like, it parallels basically where the wealth in the community is, and we're going to see that as we drive down Veterans and see, you know, five or so groceries in one line over here.
Actually, there are 10 large supermarkets in a row.
Target, Kroger, Walmart, Sam's Club, Meijer, Jewel, Hy-Vee, Schnucks, Fresh Time, Fresh Market. I'm at 10.
These supermarkets aren't particularly close to residential neighborhoods, but there is a difference between here and the situation in West Bloomington.
The houses are kind of sectioned off from the grocery stores, but the difference is that most of the houses here have access to vehicles. And so you don't have to, you know, rely on the public transportation system or getting a ride from someone else or waiting until someone is done with the car. Most of the houses over here have, if not one, multiple vehicles that they have at their disposal to be able to go to any of these grocery stores that we're going to pass by.
It doesn't appear likely that any large supermarket chain will move into West Bloomington anytime soon. Eric Haverson is a spokesman for the Cincinnati-based Kroger company. Kroger has several stores in Bloomington Normal.
In the long term, to invest in an area, we need to be confident that we'll see a return on the investment and even anticipate growth in our business once it's there.
Haverson says the Kroger on Main Street near the Bloomington and Normal borderlines can serve residents of the West Side. But that store is 2 miles from the West Side's Old Town neighborhood and 3 miles from the Sunnyside neighborhood where the Active Garden is. The Main Street store does not have a full-service butcher, a fresh seafood department, or a full-service bakery, as the East Side College Avenue store does.
That takes us back to the idea of the data and the research that goes into determining where a store can be the most successful. Look at the population studies, look at demographics of an area to get a sense for the available food dollars in a certain area. And when we put a store in a location, we want it to succeed.
A few grassroots organizations have stepped into the breach with programs that help provide West Bloomington residents with fresh produce free of charge. One of those programs is the Veggie Oasis. On Saturday mornings, Deborah Halperin of the Revitalization Project is there helping residents find lettuce, potatoes, and beans laid out on folding tables on West Washington Street.
Some of this is a convenience issue, that if there's fresh produce near you and that you can easily access it, you're more likely to go get it and eat it. And that's what we want, is people to have more fresh, healthy produce in their diets.
Veggie Oasis depends on getting donations from what's left over at the Bloomington Normal Farmers Market.
We say, hey, you know, is there anything you're not taking back to the farm today? Would you like to donate anything to our project? And we gather up that food, and it is a substantial amount of food. Our farmers are very generous. We couldn't do it without them.
Halperin says the number of people who come to the Veggie Oasis seeking free food has grown steadily. One of the regulars is Altheria Betts. She was passing by one day and saw the sign for the Veggie Oasis.
And I asked people, and they told me that you could get free vegetables here from the farmer's market.
Betts says she is trying to eat healthily to avoid some of the problems that have affected other members of her family.
Stroke, cancer, brain tumors, diabetes, high blood pressure, all of that.
The nearest full-service grocery stores to Betts' neighborhood are the West Side Walmart and an Aldi's near Market Street. Both are off Route 55, about 2 miles from residential neighborhoods. Betts says she has a car, but many of her neighbors don't. They have to take buses to shop.
You got to get on the bus and wait for the bus. It might be raining one day. You got to carry the food on the bus. And what if you don't have any help?
Herein lies another characteristic of food deserts: poor access to transportation. Halperin of the West Bloomington Revitalization Board says that for many West Side residents, getting to a full-service supermarket on a regular basis in another part of town is a hardship.
They don't have a car. You know, they rely on a bus. Maybe the bus comes once an hour. So between your two jobs and getting your kids to school and all the other things families have to do, it's another thing you have to schedule in, if you don't have a car, is how to get to the grocery store and back.
The Veggie Oasis only operates part of the year. It begins in early summer and ends in late October. It is then that another grassroots program kicks in, also run by volunteers.
I've got a lot of apples today. A lot of chorizo soup in here today.
On weekends, Beacon of Hope volunteers Gary Calhoun and Joe Ellen Scott make the rounds of supermarkets. Calhoun drives to the store's loading docks in a truck from his architectural metals business. He then packs up the produce the supermarkets no longer want to sell, as well as other foods like bread, milk, soup, and yogurt that are slightly past their sell-by date. Scott says Beacon of Hope is on a food rescue mission.
We are a nonprofit looking to help eliminate food waste and give back to the community. We're bringing anywhere from 5 to 30 boxes of food, which is very unpredictable. We never know from week to week what we might get.
Scott surveys the food she and Calhoun collected, now arrayed on folding tables outside the offices of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project.
So this apple here has a bruise on it. And they would have had to throw out the whole bag of apples where,
just,
you know, I could
that.
Go home and cut around it and still use it.
Yeah. So is it pretty hit or miss then? For
Armando Baez, who
up?
Works for the Revitalization Project, oversees the twice weekly food giveaways.
Every Thursday and Saturday, we have usually 3 tables of food, and at the end of the day, the food is gone. There's nothing left over. So to me, in my mind, that says there is a need for food on the west side of town.
Sometimes the offerings are a bit exotic, like the oat milk and shiitake mushrooms on offer this particular Saturday. But the people who come, like this Hispanic man who declined to give his name, say the residents appreciate whatever free food they can get.
It's a way for survival, I guess.
There is one supermarket that's near to the residential homes of West Bloomington.
This is a locally produced milk in Fairbury, Illinois, and
Greentop Grocery opened less than a year ago.
For us.
Its planners stress that its location would shrink the size of West Bloomington's food desert. But Greentop isn't your usual grocery store. It's a cooperative, funded in part by the $200 memberships its customers buy. It is more of a boutique grocery than a full-service market, a place where you can buy sesame seaweed salad, oat milk, sparkling grapefruit wine, as well as organically grown produce and locally baked breads that are typically more expensive than supermarket brands. Most of the people who came seeking free food at the West Bloomington Veggie Oasis told me they had never heard of Greentop or that they couldn't afford its prices. A gallon of milk, $3.49. A loaf of rye bread, $6. A loaf of Paisano bread, $5.50.
Our prices are a little bit higher than a conventional store, and part of that is because of our size and how much we can order.
That's Rainey Themer, marketing manager of Greentop. She said the store recently lowered prices on about 400 items, many of them basics. Now, purple signs adorn many of the shelves announcing special sales on certain staples like cereals. Green tags connote other sale items.
The purple signs you see in our store, those are basic items that you find in our grocery store that we sell at cost or below cost for us. And so they'll be more of your grains, your vegetables, milk, eggs, items that everybody needs.
Themer also points to the store's teaching kitchen. Most of the customers are affluent whites who now attend the cooking classes. But she says the store hopes to reach more of its neighbors.
You can give somebody produce, but if they don't know how to cook, we're not really giving them access. So we offer 2 to 3 cooking classes a month in our teaching kitchen. Some of these are feed classes, but our most basic classes we offer for free.
Volunteers working to bring healthier food to the families of West Bloomington say all of their efforts combined amount to only a stopgap measure. The Veggie Oasis and Beacon of Hope food giveaways and Colleen Connolly's Active Garden might serve only a few hundred people at best. Armando Baez of the Revitalization Project says the West Side needs a long-term solution.
There has to be some source of food or grocery store or something for residents that especially don't have transportation or whatever it might be. Like, there has to be something on the West Side. So I think that's part of our role and other people, other volunteers' role to be active. It's because I don't see a store being built. For now, this is our solution.
Deborah Halperin of the Revitalization Project says other communities are trying creative approaches to address the food crisis in their neighborhoods.
Maybe there's a way there could be a combo grocery store gas station. You know, if you have to get gas on your way home, could you also pop in and pick up a rotisserie chicken? I think if we wait we're going to be as stuck as we are now. So we should be looking at other ways that communities are responding to these challenges because our families need us now.
That, Halperin acknowledges, will take both long-term planning and perhaps government intervention to offer enticements to businesses to build supermarkets in lower-income neighborhoods. I'm Judy Valente.
The Agriculture Department says about 19 million Americans live in low-income areas that are 1 to 10 miles from the nearest supermarket. Only about 8% of African Americans live in a census tract with a supermarket, compared to 31% of whites. Tomorrow, GLT's Judy Valente talks more with Greentop Grocery's marketing manager, Rainey Thiemer, about the store's struggle to reach more minorities. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Constitution Place Self-Storage, offering new units in six sizes and your choice of regular or climate-controlled. Located just north of Empire and Linden, next to Constitution Trail in Bloomington. Rental information at 829-1700 or constitutionplace.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner did not fare well in his first face-to-face meeting with his primary opponent, Jeannie Ives. That's the topic of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. Also on the panel are Charlie Wheeler of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, Daisy Contreras of IPR, and Rick Pearson, the political reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who watched the meeting before the paper's editorial board.
It was, I think, pretty clear that this was a governor who didn't want to be in that room. He's done his best to try to dismiss this primary challenge from Jeannie Ives, a three-term state representative from Wheaton. And this will likely be the only time that these two face off. She was very much the aggressor and raised a lot of the issues that conservatives feel that they've been betrayed upon. That abortion bill, for example, Ives says basically was the genesis of her running for office. And there's no doubt that conservatives are very frustrated by that, the fact that the governor had said during his campaign that he had no social agenda. And she basically has now labeled him as the only thing that he's accomplished in his 3 years in office is a progressive social agenda. And, you know, to the point that one of the common things the conservatives have said is that in thinking through this bill, Rauner pledged to Republicans, legislators, that he would veto it, even pledged that he would veto it to Cardinal Blaise Cupich, the head of the Archdiocese of Chicago. And he was asked directly, what did you tell the cardinal? The governor wouldn't answer it directly.
Charlie, is it as dire for Bruce Rauner as maybe the media is making this out to be? Because we've heard a lot of people saying, well, she certainly, delivered the knockout punch to him appearance together. But a lot of people out there agree with the decision he made on that legislation and other pieces of legislation that conservatives have problems with.
Well, that's true. But I think Rick expressed it well when he said that he did not want to be there. He did not want a primary opponent. He did not want to face off against Jeannie Ives. And from what I heard and what I saw, he was certainly very uncomfortable. She seemed better prepared. She seemed to be more on her game. He was kind of flailing around. As a matter of fact, the Tribune's cartoonist Scott Stannis had a pretty graphic illustration where Jeannie Ives is sitting poised at the desk and Bruce Rauner is upended, his feet are up in the air, and he said, but I'm not in charge, or something like that. So it was really a disaster for him. And you wonder, it's not going to be fatal. I don't think Jeannie Ives is going to have the funding or the backing to be able to beat him in the primary, but it's not a good thing when a sitting governor has a significant portion of his own party who's adamantly opposed to him.
Well, Rick, I think a lot of folks I've talked to get the feeling as though that he feels defeated, that he's not, you know, he doesn't have the fighting spirit that maybe he had when he was running the first time for governor. Is that coming across from at least what you're seeing?
I would absolutely agree. I even went back yesterday to look at one of his general election debates against Pat Quinn. Much more energetic, much more confident. Now, in his recent public appearances, there's a noticeable lack of energy, a noticeable lack of enthusiasm, of just almost like he's always very to the point and repeating his talking points, but merely just kind of reciting them by rote without any kind of, push behind it. The number of times in that Tribune editorial board meeting where everything was about Mike Madigan, I think maybe we should start taxing the term Mike Madigan, and maybe that'll get us out of our financial hole, because it just became almost laughable, because you knew what the answer to every question to him was going to be, is it's Mike Madigan's fault.
And Charlie, we heard this week from a sitting state lawmaker. His name is John Cabello. He is from the Rockford area, Republican. He's also been a big Donald Trump supporter. I believe he was the chair of Trump's campaign here in Illinois during the last election. He actually said on the day of the State of the State address afterward that Governor Rauner should resign. He backs Jeannie Ives. This reminds me, and you can talk about that, but this also reminds me a bit of George Ryan's last few months in office. It seemed as though the party pulled away from George Ryan. There was this undercurrent that many people felt he couldn't win. So he, of course, decided not to run for re-election. I get a very similar feel right now from what I'm seeing with Rauner.
Well, one of the differences, I think, is that George Ryan actually had accomplishments during his time in office. He had a public works program that was pretty impressive. He helped broker deals dealing with factory farms and with HMO abuses. He actually presided over the state at a time when we did have balanced budgets and budgetary surpluses until 9/11.
The death penalty situation.
Yeah. And his problems had to do more with ethics and the fact that there was this cloud over him and the, at least what appeared to be at the time, the possibility that he might actually be charged with some criminal offense, which ultimately he was. So his decision wasn't because of actions that he had taken. It was because he probably felt that he wasn't going to win. And it wasn't that he didn't understand the job or didn't do a good job while he was in there as governor. It was simply the handwriting was on the wall, I would say. And I don't think he ever had the kind of public outcry from within the party that Rauner has seen.
And Rick, would you agree or disagree that there's some similarities there between these two?
Well, I think the one major factor here is that Bruce Rauner was using his personal wealth to buy loyalty among rank-and-file Republican members and concentrated the power of the whole Republican apparatus through the use of his wallet. That certainly wasn't the case with George Ryan. And George Ryan, was an old hand, as Charlie said, and he was known to be kind of a bipartisan deal maker. That was one of his hallmarks. But the distancing factor, the commonality is, if people start seeing, and quite frankly, that probably was the reason that we saw the budget enacted, that we saw a tax increase enacted over Rauner's veto, is the fact that now people, including many Republicans, are looking at their own districts, knowing election time is up for them, and what do I have to show for back in my district as a result of having Bruce Rauner as my leader? I think that's the hard question that a lot of Republicans are asking right now.
Sometimes you can tell how popular someone is, a governor, when they give a speech before a joint session of the General Assembly. Daisy Contreras with us. She watched the State of the State take place. You were in the House chamber when the governor delivered his remarks. And we're not expecting that the Democrats are going to stand up, give a lot of standing ovations to Bruce Rauner. But the reception was a bit cooler on the Republican side as well.
Yeah, and, you know, he's certainly, as you mentioned earlier, aiming for re-election. So he focused most of his speech points on the state's positive aspects, such as innovation and technology, partnerships with universities across the state, fighting the opioid crisis with several initiatives, and helping small businesses thrive through tax credits. But yeah, what most people walked away with and had most reaction to was his remark on bringing forth a balanced budget in 2 weeks. The governor received what I would call a standing ovation from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Many of them say they are not confident he will achieve that this year either.
With that standing ovation, was it sort of a smack of a bit of irony there that they would give him a standing ovation for that? Most of them don't feel he's ever produced a balanced budget.
And I think that's what
that's
it was.
True. He never has. And I would say more than irony, it was like sarcasm.
Sarcasm.
If nothing else. Yeah, it's like, come on, give us a break. As a matter of fact, it was just a couple days ago or so that he got another pants on fire rating for claiming to have produced balanced budgets in the past. He's probably the only person in the state of Illinois who maybe thinks he did.
Well, Charlie, just the other day, he was asked about that comment in an interview with a downstate newspaper, and he said that he feels like he introduced balanced budgets.
Well, to me, what he's done, it'd be like me saying, I'm going to go out and buy a Maserati, but it's going to fit within my budget because I'm going to win the lottery.
Well, when we talk about the governor's address to the General Assembly as well, he also discussed taxes in this a little bit, and especially he talked property taxes, but he also talked the income tax. It seems like he wants to try to roll back the tax or come up with a plan to roll back the tax that was just enacted. And he gave no indication of how he's going to do this, how he's going to make it all work. But this was something that also, I think, caught people's eye.
Yeah, not just that, but he focused on the state's growth potential and bringing back public trust. I think that was a key topic in his speech. He called on lawmakers to enact term limits, which is definitely not a new talking point for him, especially when referring to Mike Madigan. And he argued that without term limits or all of these type of reforms on taxes, the state can't move forward. He called for unity and bipartisan support and said that this is the only way to achieve anything that Illinois is capable of achieving. But if we have seen anything in the past year, the General Assembly is far from being united.
Rick, speaking of Mike Madigan, that being mentioned there, he issued one of the, I think, more surprising statements, and this was just a written statement on the day of that speech that I have seen from the speaker in most of the years I've been covering him. And that was, he really went off. He basically talked about the governor should stay on the sidelines since he's not in charge. Again, a little bit of sarcasm thrown in there. There was also, really just a very negative response from the speaker. He usually takes a bit more of a high road in these types of comments that are made. Were you surprised by that?
I was. Just because of the fact that, unlike virtually every other appearance the governor makes in the State of the State speech, he didn't mention Madigan by name. It was very unique in that aspect. So I was surprised. But, when you've got the millions of dollars that Bruce Rauner has used virtually from the time he came into office, basically trying to make Mike Madigan as the boogeyman for all of the state's ills, I suppose it's kind of a natural reaction. But, in that State of the State speech as well, he kept talking about, Illinois has laid the groundwork for like this, business growth and renaissance if only my changes, pro-business changes are enacted. But when you have to say laying the groundwork, what are the fine points behind that? You're, coming to the end of your first term, laying the groundwork doesn't really show that anything's been accomplished.
Shirley, you've written and talked a lot here on the show, too, about the fact that other governors have been able to work, even Republicans, with Speaker Madigan through the many years he's been in that position. And of course, the governor seemed to talk about bipartisanship. Let's try to work together. Is it too late on this relationship now? Do you think Madigan has any interest, even if it's something he might agree with? Would he basically put the past aside and try to work with Rauner?
I would hope that he would if Rauner were really serious about wanting to do it. If you look at the things for which Rauner claimed credit in the speech, he talked about the reduction in the prison population. Well, a lot of those reforms were achieved not because the governor said, here's what I want, bow down and give it to me. It was bipartisan compromise worked out by lawmakers from both sides of the aisle and the governor's people. The same thing with the education funding. That occurred not because of Bruce Rauner, but almost in spite of Bruce Rauner. And so the question in my mind would be, does Madigan want to do anything that might help rehabilitate Rauner as an effective governor? And weighing against that would be his desire to move forward on these issues that are important to his members and to the people of the state. And I don't know how that's going to work out.
Members of the Illinois Politics Roundtable are Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR's Sean Crawford and Daisy Contreras, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm Mike McCurdy, and this is Sound Ideas on GLT. An update on the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene from the man who runs the Facebook page with the same name. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Larry Karius ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A diverse range of studio practices from artists who spend much of their time in the classroom is currently on view in Uptown Normal. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The University Galleries in Uptown Normal currently is showing the 2018 Faculty Biennial, with works ranging from paintings to metals to sculpture and graphic design. University Galleries curator Jason Judd says this show is an opportunity for the town and gown community members to see what the School of Art faculty are working on. Judd points out an installation by artist Aaron Palucci, who's the arts tech director. The work features a chair before a huge set of speakers and an audio processor.
Aaron brought in this incredible sound installation, which is a combination of these speakers that act or are actual sculpture elements. So he did make those speakers.
You mean he didn't go to Best Buy to get these?
He did not go to Best Buy, surprisingly, to get these, because speakers are becoming smaller and smaller every day,
they
right?
Are.
So you usually don't see something of this size. But along with the visual elements of this, there is a sound element. And what it is, if you sit in this seat, you get a holographic sonic representation of the sounds. So wherever the sounds may sound like they should be coming from, not unlike surround sound, this kind of gives you that atmosphere within this kind of 10-foot radius.
Let's hear some of that sound.
Okay.
So it sounds like we're in a crowded deli.
There's a variety of sounds. It's about a half an hour long sound piece, and it is a mixture of open source sounds from YouTube, which he has taken, remixed, re-edited to produce this kind of sonic landscape. So there's this kind of bustling, maybe cafe area right now, but there could be a race car next, or there could be a very serene nature walk going on.
And what's the name of this piece?
Dipole Line Array, which is the speaker design, and then transport as the sound design.
That is really cool. Let's take a look at some of the other items you have on display. So I noticed on the list of faculty, you have John Miller showing here. John Miller is a glass artist.
He is. John Miller has been in the School of Art for a long time, and he has two distinctly different works of art in the show. One is two pieces of food, if you will, right? Sculptures of food.
Let's see
which
them.
We're going to have to take a walk to the other room here.
So it's glass food that he's made.
So
something very tempting?
Something that, some of his work does include these glass sculptures of a larger-than-life-size food. So within that, he made these, somewhat modestly-sized pieces for John Miller, of a hamburger and a donut. And instead of this being a multicolored glass piece, they're chrome glass pieces.
Gorgeous. So, and there's actually sprinkles on the donut.
There's actually sprinkles on the donut. And they have that chrome sheen just like an old bumper on a 50s car.
Sparkling. A wonderful patina.
It is. It's this, at night, since we're by the windows in this gallery, when the rest of the lights shut off, they really sparkle.
On the other side of this gallery space, there's paper all over the little bits of paper. It looks like an elementary school wall just exploded. What is this installation?
What is this? I like the elementary school, and I think that thought comes to mind because of the distinct colors, right? And the distinct way of writing and thinking about maybe strange graphs or funny words that you might not be familiar with.
And cool little doodles and stick
doodles
figures.
On ripped pieces of paper and note cards and big. This is arts technology professor Derek Downey. Interestingly enough, he works primarily in virtual reality and coding. So he's a very tech-oriented person. But he came to us here at University Galleries with a box full of paper and had said, you know, I make these on my off time. They're just things I think about. They're doodles.
There's hundreds of them.
There's hundreds of them. Could I maybe show these? So, you know, we decided to forego the technology and said, you know, why don't you put these up how you feel they should be seen? And he kind of feels like this is another persona of a madman, of somebody trying to figure something out. So they're literally taped with masking tape you can see on here. And like you said, they fill up the whole space. And actually, he has even more, which is incredible. He could have filled the whole entire gallery. There's something spiritual. There's something new wave about them. There's also something a little bit slapstick and comical, right? That they don't take themselves too seriously to tell you something real. And I think a interesting question to ask yourself is this Derek who thinks these things, or does he let himself go to another person who thinks these things?
Let's take a further look around. So there's this installation here that goes from the baseboards up to the ceiling, which is like 18 feet. And it's bright yellow. It's almost like a traffic sign, mm-hmm. with black characters all over it. What are we looking at?
We have a collaboration between two graphic design professors who came together to think about the idea of translation. Laden, one of the graphic design professors, she writes and knows Persian. And then Alice Lee, the other collaborator, knows and writes Korean. So together they were thinking about the graphic elements of each alphabet, how that comes together formally, and what that means when it's read by the viewer in that interaction.
Why the size? Why did they choose to make this so ginormous?
Well, we really try to give each of the faculty members a large amount of space. And we say, you know, use as much of the wall up to the ceiling as you want. And they took us literally doing this. That made us happy. And if you look, they're very skillful at layout and design. So making this incredibly large wall look sophisticated, smart, and interesting seems to be second nature to them. You can look at it from across the room, and you really get this full-scale experience about what you're reading in each of the alphabets. When you come closer, you can start to see the different typefaces of the different letters they use. But furthermore, there are these little flashlights you can get off the wall, and you can turn that on and bring it over to these strange acrylic fonts here.
Oh, when you shine it on.
It creates the shadow of some of those letter forms that they're interested in. Many people can come and, you know, really interact through light with it. So there's a really great dimension of space.
That's curator Jason Judd from the University Galleries, currently showing the 2018 Faculty Biennial. That's up now through February 11th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see a gallery of photos from the show on the datebook page of WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. NPR One is a whole new way to listen.
I've been using NPR One for over a year now.
Catch up on NPR and GLT News. Customize the app for you.
I like how you can just set it and forget it, and it learns what you like over time.
Share what you like, skip what you don't, It's public radio made personal.
I'm Devin Akman from Bloomington, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at wglt.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The food service industry is a volatile one. Turnover in establishments can approach 100% in just a few years. 2017 was an active year for restaurant openings and closures. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Larry Carius, who writes about the Bloomington restaurant scene on Facebook. Carius says 2018 has started out with significant activity as well.
We've had several that have opened since January 1st already. Zen Express is a sushi bowl restaurant on North Main in Normal. It's on the corner of Orlando and Main Street. It's in the former Pizza Hut. Who Hot Mongolian Barbecue opened. They don't like to hear me say it, but essentially it's very similar to a flat top grill, except I think when people go there, it's a little nicer, has a larger selection. And this is a smaller chain that is becoming very popular.
Where are they?
They're located adjacent to the north of TJ Maxx. One that has just opened about 3 weeks ago is the Donut Experiment.
Isn't that in Morrissey Crossing?
Or as some of us old-timers still call it, Brantville. The Donut Experiment, I think, is a very interesting story. A woman from the Atlanta McLean area, when she and her husband and family were vacationing in Florida. A couple years ago, they came across a donut shop called the Donut Experiment. When she came home, she started to investigate about getting a franchise. When the shop opened a couple weeks ago, it was the result of 2 years' work, and they are doing very well out there.
Maple bacon donuts, nothing to sneer at.
That was my favorite. I think I've had two of them so far, and I'm not really a donut person, but those were very, very good.
There's a new Indian restaurant in town, too.
Yes, it's one that just opened toward the end of the year. It's called Aroma, and it is in the former Happy Hour location on El Dorado Road in Bloomington. A couple things I found interesting about this was not only do they have the Indian food from all regions of India, but they also have a few menu items that they call their Indochina menu items.
Who are the recent closures?
Well, we had one big closure and actually a couple smaller closures. Swinger's Grill, located on the far west side of Bloomington, where the driving range is. They closed. I knew they were struggling out there maybe the last year or so, but it was quite a surprise when they did decide to close. Another place to close was one of my absolutely favorite restaurants, PT's Barbecue on Clinton Street. I thought that their brisket sandwiches and their pulled pork sandwiches were absolutely the best in town. I don't live too far from there, and I enjoyed their sandwiches, and I was very disappointed when they closed. When people go out to the Eastland Mall food court, there's only two restaurants left open in the food court, and that is because Quenchers, the smoothie place that's been there for several years, that closed about the middle of January.
Who's still hanging on?
Great Steaks hanging on, and then there's Kobe's, which is out there, that's been out there for several years. They're still open.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene with Larry Carius. There were some significant anniversaries over the course of the year.
We've had two recent ones. Cafe Italian, I always try to give them a plug. Locally owned. Frank Composto does a great job there. He's just celebrated 6 years, which in the restaurant business is actually quite a long time, and I think he's doing pretty well out there. Another one, Winner's Bar, which is on South Center Street in Bloomington. Dave Engel, the owner of Winner's, has just celebrated 35 years there. And 35 years in the bar business is a long time, Charlie.
That is. How's he managed to do that?
I'm not sure. I think he enjoys it.
The restaurant business often results in turnover because people are unwilling or unable to plunk down the significant chunk of change that it takes to refresh a restaurant or an establishment. There were a couple places that did make a big investment.
One who just finished, Joe's Station Pizza out at College Hills Plaza. They just went in there and plunked down $200,000, which is rather a princely sum. They put in an entirely new bar, which is about 20 foot longer than the old one. Their number of tap heads, they've increased from, they formerly had 12 to now they have 30 tap heads. What a lot of people may not realize, when you have that many tap heads, you have to have, in layman's term, special beer cooling lines. They had to double the size of their walk-in beer cooler. They had to put in a glycol cooling system.
It's an antifreeze system, basically, right?
Basically. And I'm not quite sure how it works, but it costs them $30,000.
So you would think that 230 large would be the top investment in town, but it's not so.
Hacienda Leon, that's one place that I'm looking forward to. They're in the building on North Hershey Road, where Ming's Buffet was, where Amravati Indian Buffet was, and they went in there and they absolutely gutted the place except for the kitchen and the restrooms. They threw a figure at me of $250,000. They say this is going to be the only hacienda in town. And I said, well, what exactly is a hacienda? And they kind of looked at me funny, but they said that a hacienda is a very nice gathering place.
So let's recap the year. Taken as a whole, openings versus closings, what was the picture for the scene?
Roughly, according to my records, we had 32 restaurants open. We had 17 restaurants closed. So we've had almost twice as many open as we had closed.
You know, that sounds remarkably like the same story we had last year. Is Bloomington Normal over-restauranted?
That's the $64,000 question there, Charlie. What I will say, and frankly, I don't know what the answer is, but after what I would call the big three opened, after Portillo's opened, after Giordano's opened, after Oberweiss opened, I've had...
And the Distill Brewery, too.
And the Distill Brewery. I've had successful restaurant owners tell me that they've noticed a difference. Not that their business was bad, it was their business was down slightly. And that it only stands to reason when you look at the hundreds of thousand dollars or the millions that go through Portillo's, Oberweiss, Giordano's. That's not all new money generated. It's that the pie gets cut just a little bit thinner, and some of that money is coming from some of the other restaurants.
What are some of the significant but perhaps lesser-known openings that that people should have taken into account or may still take into account now that they're established in this 2018?
As a matter of fact, we have a bakery in downtown Bloomington that's open, Ivy Lane Bakery on, I think it's the 400 block of North Main Street in downtown Bloomington. Another local place that open and is doing well. In fact, it's located in the former Beningo's restaurant on the near west side of Bloomington. It's Crawford's Corner Pub. Bob Crawford and his partner went there, literally gutted the entire place. This is a very nice pub food restaurant. I think people would really enjoy it if they stopped by. The Spotted Dog, from what I understand, is doing very well. This is the little bar that was called Dub Bar on Morrissey Avenue, kind of across from Grady's Pizza. Nick Hurley went in there and did some work and well, the place has been closed for several years, and from what I understand, he's doing very well. Two other larger places, Namaste Plaza Supermarket. This is a $3 million Indian grocery, Indian supermarket that opened in the former Hancock Fabric building on El Dorado in Bloomington. It's not only Indian food, it's Asian food, various other types of food. If people haven't stopped by there, I would encourage them to.
You know, sometimes people don't take into account hotel restaurants. Now, that is not the case because Braze has become a destination place out on near Tawanda Barnes Road in GE. But there's perhaps one other hotel restaurant that that people might want to look at.
The Radisson opened up in North Normal, North Main Street. The owners are from Northern Illinois. The managing partner, he said they put $18 million in a place, and they put in a Trader Grills restaurant. And when people walk into the hotel lobby and they see the large bar, they see the large dining area and that, I find it to be quite striking. And I don't think that there's that many local people know that it's there, but I would encourage them to stop by just to take a look, if nothing else.
So can they become a Baxter's and a Braze in terms of local popularity that has its own identity on top of the Radisson Hotel?
I think they can. When you look at the, shall we say, nicer restaurants, there's restaurants up in that area, but there's not really, for lack of a better term, a nicer restaurant. But the menu they have is not a Baxter's type menu. It's more of a small plate menu in that. But the place is a nice looking place, nice looking bar, nice looking dining room.
Among the 17 restaurants that closed in 2017 include Stolfus Pizza on Linden and the Market Street Bakery after 30 years. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.